Okay, so first of all, let me say that I'm honored and delighted to be here. And actually, it's not that my time is so valuable, but this is the final speaker session. This is the only reason why I'm here just for a few hours. Frankly speaking, the time question wasn't really the main challenge of this talk or this presentation, but the main sort of challenge is intellectual, because Peter asked me to give a tutorial on Brownian motion to the audience that consists probably mostly of experts on Brownian motion. So I was thinking, first of all, what can you say about Brownian motion in 2 hours? Well, perhaps just enough for the definition. And second, what can you tell, I mean, experts about Brownian motion? So the talk will be, in the end, the talk will be about 75% philosophy and 25% science, which I think most people will find relaxing. So you can relax and don't worry, there won't be that much substance. Okay. So I will start with a paradox. It's based on a definition of Brownian motion, and so there's a little story to, you know, related to this. When I arrived at Berkeley as a student, David Aldous was also a fresh faculty, so he also arrived as a faculty. And I took his class on stochastic processes, and this was the first and the last time in my life when I've heard or that I've seen a certain definition of Brownian motion. So this is the first time since then that, you know, I presented to someone. And David Aldous said that apparently this is the definition that is used by physicists. Well, I know that there's at least one physicist in the audience, so perhaps the physicists, if there's more than one physicist, that they will tell me whether this definition is actually used by physicists or not. Okay, so first of all, what's the main idea of the definition? The main idea of the definition is this: we are trying to somehow define or understand a continuous process. So in this picture, the horizontal axis represents time, the vertical represents space. This is a one-dimensional case. We're talking about the one-dimensional Brownian motion. And if you're thinking about, in experimental terms, you're observing some kind of a curve, and the accuracy of your observations is finite. So actually, you really don't expect to observe exactly one curve, but perhaps you might ask yourself, what is the probability that you would observe a curve within a certain tube? So you see, the tube is defined, you know, there's this middle line, that's the black curve, is a function. And to make things simple, I assume that the second derivative is bounded. So it's a nice function. Okay, and then there is a tube of size epsilon along this. So here's the definition. The Brownian motion Bt. Brownian motion Bt is a random function that has this distribution. So the question is, what is the probability that you will observe a particular path of Brownian motion? Well, here it is. The particular path that sits within this tube, the probability of this is, first of all, there is some normalizing constant depending on epsilon, because obviously if epsilon is small, the probability will be smaller. And then the main part of the expression is this exponential. So where's the paradox? Okay, when you look at this expression, you start thinking, okay, so which Brownian paths are most likely? And what does it mean, most likely? When is this, mathematically, it means when is this expression the largest? So this is an exponential of something negative. Please note that the integral, this is the integral of a square of some function, which means that that integral is non-negative. Then we take exponential of minus that integral, which means that to maximize the whole expression, we have to minimize the integral. How do we minimize the integral? Well, the smallest possible value for something that is non-negative is zero, okay? So to minimize this, f prime has to be zero. And it can be zero. That's one particular case, when f prime is zero. So what we get from this is that expression is maximized by a function that is simply constant equal to zero. So this is the most likely shape of the Virgin pad, according to that definition. And then I thought, okay, so let me compare this definition with the real life. So what I'm going to show you is an illustration, some data, real life data, and I decided to support some local company. And here it is. So these are this is the Microsoft stock in the last 5 years. And then I looked at it and looked, and I started asking myself whether this picture actually proves or disproves the claim that Graham pads are flat. If you ask any investor, they will tell you that the Microsoft stock was flat for the last 5 years. But I guess I will let you draw your own conclusions. By the way, I'm going to return to this paradox later. If you do not understand the paradox at this point, I will let you think about this, and I will comment on this later. Okay, so now let me give you an alternative definition of Gramian motion. Actually, this is not the definition that is usually given in textbooks on graduate probability. I just thought that it would be a sort of more interesting definition. Well, usually this is a theorem, that there's a unique process with the following properties. It has no memory. By the way, I'm going to explain what this means. So it has no memory, it has a certain invariance properties, and it is continuous. Now, there is actually one more, but this property is sort of trivial. It's just to sort of normalize the process in some sense and get rid of triviality. So the fourth condition is just to make sure that this is actually a unique process. Okay, so actually the idea of no memory, I mean, this can have, there's more than one interpretation. And in this case, I mean the following. If you consider disjoint intervals between T0 and T1, and then T1, T2, T2 to T3, and so on, then the increments of Gramian motion are independent. Okay, so that's one interpretation of the lack of memory, and this is appropriate for this particular definition. Then invariance. Okay, I will actually talk about a number of invariance properties of Gramian motion in this particular case. So for this definition, the invariance that we need is that invariance under shifts, time shifts, so an increment of Gramian motion from S to T plus S has always the same distribution, and that does not depend on S, only on the length of the interval, which is T. And then continuity. Well, actually that part in some sense is the least trivial. No matter how we define Gramian motion, continuity, for example, if you define it in such a way that continuity is not involved in the definition itself, then proving continuity is not trivial. I mean, by now it's standard because, you know, I mean, this is a classical theorem and so on, but to this day, this is more than an exercise for students. If you don't know how to do it, I mean, it would take you some time to prove that. So, so this is non-trivial. But you know, as I said, by now it is pretty much standard. Since I mentioned continuity, let me mention obviously that the next thing that comes to mind, this has nothing to do with the definition, this is already a theorem, namely Gramian path is nowhere differentiable. And this means it gives me a pretext to discuss one particular aspect of the whole theory, namely the question of the strength of certain statements. You see, Gramian non-differentiability is the strongest possible non-differentiability you can possibly have for a stochastic process. There are certain things that happen with probability zero for Gramian motion or with probability one. So let's have a look at this illustration. Let's have a look, for example, at the question whether this process takes value 25. Well, if you fix time, such as here, January 2005, then the probability that the stock price is exactly 25 on that particular day is zero. But that does not mean, it's a different statement or different question, whether the process ever takes value 25. And obviously these are, the answers are different in this particular case. So on a particular day, the probability of 25 is zero, but well, there are infinitely many actually times when the Brownian motion would be 25 for this version. So going back here, this is the strongest possible statement in the sense that with probability one, when you take a path, it will not be differentiable even at a single point. Even at a single point. So it's as non-differentiable as they come. Okay, so now we are going to more into philosophy. Why would we want to even think about Brownian motion? I guess physicists may have their own reasons, but we mathematicians have our own reasons. Namely, this is a very nice process to work with because it has all kinds of good properties. It belongs to several families of well-understood stochastic processes. And then I will go one by one and say a few words about one of these Markov processes, martingales, Gaussian processes, Levine processes. And the point is that mathematicians develop basically a separate theory for each one of these. These are well-developed theories, there are lots of theorems, and therefore it's easy to work with Brownian motion because you have tools from all kinds of fields of probability and not only probability. So first, Markov processes. What does it mean that the process is Markov? Okay, so this is a different version of the lack of memory. It's closely related to the previous version, but not identical. Now here, L stands for law or distribution. So what this means is that if you're trying to predict what's going to happen in the future, so the present is S. You're at time S, okay? And you're trying to predict the future. The future is BT, T greater or equal to S. If you're going to try to predict this, then your prediction will be as good if it is based on the current value of Brownian motion or whether it is based on all the past values of the Brownian motion. It doesn't matter. The process has no memory. If you know what happened in the past, this gives you no advantage, no extra information. So you can as well forget it. So this in itself is very convenient when it comes to probabilistic estimates because, well, you don't have to worry about what happened in the past. If the process is at some point, or for example, the process exists a domain at some point, then you don't have to ask any questions about how it did, how the process reached that point. You can just look at the future and starting from that point. But that's not the end of the story. Well, in some sense, this is a part of the story because that probabilistic property somehow allows us to relate Markov processes to lots of analytic techniques and tools. And they come, well, they are related. This is sort of the rough classification and some kind of labels, but traditionally, probably that was the oldest relationship between Markov processes and analysis via transition semigroups, functional analysis. There's a relation to potential theory, harmonic functions, the Green function, spectral theory, eigenfunction expansions, and so on, and PDE's heat equation, probably more than I did not list here. Now, martingales. I have to say that I was always fascinated by the word martingale. Whenever I ask students in a class if they know what a martingale is, most of them think that it's a bird. Or they think that they think about martingales. Okay, so a martingale is not a nightingale, and a martingale is not a horse either. The martingale is the strap. It's the strap that keeps the head of the horse down. Okay. So, by the way, this has nothing to do with science or probability. Okay. So this is the real definition of a martingale. And somebody even suggested that there was some kind of way how it went from horses to probability. I think there are some gambling or something. Well, anyhow.
Conspiracy theories.
Theories, yes, most martingales. Okay. So what is a martingale? A martingale is a process that has no tendency to go up or down. Well, in this sense, namely that if we know the value in this case it's Brownian motion. So if we know the value of Brownian motion at time s, and we are trying to predict the value at time t, well, then on average it will be s. Current value. Now, the Brownian case is actually somewhat misleading. You see, because there are so many symmetries about Brownian motions. For example, the probability that Brownian motion will go up and will go down is the same. No, that's not the concept of martingale. Martingales are not the processes that have the same probability of going up or down. No. The probability of going up can be 70%, going down 30%. But still, I mean, the point is that the steps have such size that they will balance on average. Okay, so it's not about probability. That's actually a very common mistake made by students on exams. They think that martingales have the same probability of going up or down. No, this is the, in the sense of expectation, which is a different really thing. Now, why should we care about martingales? Well, after many years of attempts to develop the theory of stochastic integration with respect to the stochastic process, it is now pretty much clear that martingales are the only family of processes for which this is a successful theory. But don't get me wrong, it's not that people are not trying and they have not achieved anything else with other processes, and I have to be honest, right now I am involved in research project that involves integration with respect to other processes, not Brownian motion, but I have to be honest and say that project will not revolutionize probability. And actually, it's a theorem. You can formulate this statement as a theorem. And I think there were two books, one pretty old from the 80s and the 70s by Métivier and Paul Moll, the French authors, and more recent by Trotter. Project, and basically they approach is this. Suppose that we want to develop a theory of stochastic integration in an axiomatic sense. So you list a list of axioms. What would you like your integrals to do? Well, for example, we want them to be linear, right? Integral of f plus the integral of g is the integral of f plus g. Probably you would like to have some kind of continuity, for example. If you have functions fn convergent to f, and the integrals of fn should converge to the integral of f. But under some assumptions and in some sense and so on. So we put a list of axioms which are very natural because they are useful actually in proofs and so on. And then it's a theorem. Then your integrator has to be a martingale. Well, more actually it's a so-called semi-martingale, but basically this is the only family. So this is why martingales are important, because as I say, this is the only family for which we have a well-developed theory of integration.
Question?
Yeah.
And what is the reason to have, for example, develop a theory for integration theory, for example, for general Markov chains?
General Markov chains. If you're, well, the word chain is usually reserved for discrete processes. Well, if it's a discrete process, then your integral is simply a sum.
No, what I mean, for example, Markov processes, general continuous Markov processes.
General continuous Markov processes. Well, I think, look, if you're talking about the one-dimensional case, a process which is Markov and continuous is a diffusion. And and again, under some mild technical conditions, all diffusions are time changes of Brownian motion. So basically, in this particular case, we are back to Brownian motion in some sense. and the diffusion, at least, you know, with some exceptions, I would say the general exceptions, right, is basically at least nice diffusions are semi-marked because they have that the sort of Brownian oscillations in the drift. So there are semi-marking there. But then of course we can go to sort of more degenerate diffusions.
What's a semi-marking?
Oh, a semi-marking. It's a marking plus a process that has a finite variation. So for that part, the integration is triggered as classical. So semi-marking is basically takes marking gas and something that we understand very well. Sorry about that. Okay. Now Gaussian processes. So what is a Gaussian process? So I hope that all people or most people know what a Gaussian or normal distribution is. The bell curve. Okay, so that's one-dimensional case. In the multi-dimensional case, it's a little bit more complicated because these are not independent. When I say here BT1, BT2, BTN, these are not independent. These random variables are not independent. So it's a multi-dimensional normal, but there are correlations here. At least that's the way I present it. Now, what is good about Gaussian processes? Well, first of all, they give you excellent bounds for tails. You see, again, what is, maybe I should have this on the slide, but what's the density? Okay, so that's standard normal density. What this means, look, this is e to negative x squared over 2. It means that the tail is just extremely light. This goes down to zero faster than an exponential. Which means that if you're asking yourself, where is my Brownian particle at a certain time? Well, there's a certain range of values where this particle can be found. If you go outside that, the probabilities just die incredibly fast. So, for example, in proofs, when you want to do summations, right, sums, infinite sums, if your sums are polynomial type or even exponential, this, that the tails will kill them. So it means that it's very convenient to have Gaussian tails in all kinds of estimates. Second moment calculations. Okay, so this is a little bit misleading because strictly speaking, this is just true. A Gaussian process is totally defined by its first moments, that is the mean and covariance structure. That's it. So this is a little bit misleading because it sounds like, oh, so the process, these processes are almost trivial. That's all you have to know about the process, the first and the second moment. But it is misleading because, you know, there are still some well-known problems about Gaussian processes that are unsolved. So and I mean sort of interesting and well-known problems. I don't mean something about some trivialities.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can formulate it properly, but it's something about Gaussian content in ellipses. It comes from, this is a very old problem that comes from statistics and like multi-dimensional.
Gaussian, what sort of
Okay, so the idea is this. You have ellipses. Ellipses?
Content
in ellipses, or the mass of the probability. Got
the integral over the ellipse of this
distribution? Yeah.
It's not a non-linear function probably, so what's the problem?
What's the problem about it?
Yeah.
Okay, so the conjecture of the problem is more or less like this. We are in the multidimensional case, you have two ellipses, and let's see, how does it go? I think that the mass, is the probability of A and the probability of B is in some relation to the probability of A intersecting B. But I forgot which way it's supposed to go. Well, anyhow, this is obvious because in some obvious cases it is absolutely obvious which way it goes, and then the conjecture is that it goes. It's always inequality going the same way. So as far as I know, this conjecture is still open. And as I say, this is a very old conjecture based on statistics. These are like confidence regions. And that there was a very sort of natural statistical conjecture. I mean, what if you have two of them and natural inequality? And there was a lot of progress made on this, but the main problem to this day is unsolved, as far as I know. So there's a literature, this is not exactly my area, but there's a literature on this. So for this reason I'm saying that this, you know, the number two is somewhat misleading, because it suggests like the processes are trivial and you can calculate that. Well, it's a very simple question, but this is still the answer. And the third reason why Gaussian processes are, I would say, important is that, again, this is a piece of philosophy. As far as I can tell, this is the of the three major groups of processes that I mentioned, Markov processes, Markov gas, and Gaussian processes. This is the only group that can be extended to multi-dimensional or multi-parameter situations. Now, what do I mean by this? There are all kinds of natural situations in science where you want to model a real-life phenomenon which is not parameterized, let's say, by just the one-dimensional parameter. So think about something like waves on the surface of the sea. So you have a surface, right? The surface of the sea. Or electrical, I don't know, potential in human brain. Okay, this is a three-dimensional object. Okay, and then you have a random process that is parameterized by points on a two-dimensional surface or three-dimensional domain. Well, there is a theory of Markov processes in two dimensions. There is a theory of martingales in three dimensions or higher dimensions. But these theories are practically unknown. I mean, there is a handful of aficionados who could do them or perhaps know them, and that's it. Because these theories were never developed to the point that actually could use them. Okay, there are a few people who know what to do with them, but that's about it. You cannot do calculations, you cannot do estimates. So I remember, you know, talks when somebody said, okay, this is modeled, you know, actually Gaussian processes were used by some people to model some things in human brain, let's say. And I said, you know, how do you know that actually this real process is Gaussian? Well, I mean, the answer was, I mean, no other mathematical model is known or usable. So who knows?
In physics, on the other hand, any interesting field theory is a non-Gaussian.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite the opposite. Because you're talking about fields.
Mm-hmm.
Space. Gaussian fields are trivial. Anything interesting is not Gaussian.
But is it Markovian or Martingale?
Well, that I don't know, because I don't know what it means.
Okay, so.
No, yes, it has a sort of a one-step Markov property.
You mean in the multidimensional sense?
Yeah.
You, for example, in the two-dimensional theory, if you conditional distribution, given, so to speak, you have to do this, given the value of the field along the curve.
Yeah, along a curve, then the what's
depends
inside and outside.
Not on what the behavior of the field is on the inside.
Yeah. But, you know, what I was trying to say, that theory is known in mathematics, but its state of development is like 1% or perhaps 1% of 1% of what is known and done for classical Markov processes indexed by time.
But people who do this axiomatic field series, like Barry Simon, is that related in any way? Five-fourths, proving triviality of five to the fourth series in a certain number of dimensions. Is that a probability theory or is it a different field? I mean, it feels like it's the same thing.
One can't answer that question without possibly causing consternation. But yeah, the
trivial extension. You get Gaussian theory with an action which is graph phi squared. You add something to it. That's your non-trivial field theory. And so, you understand what I'm saying, right?
Not exactly. You can't just add something and hope to get a field theory. The theorem about d greater than 4 is that no matter what you do, if you look at the you actually try to construct the process from such a bare Hamiltonian, as we say, then you end up with a Gaussian process.
Yeah, but I mean, we know how to do this.
No, don't.
We do.
No, above four dimensions, you won't get anything that's non-Gaussian. That's the theorem.
And above four dimensions, you don't. No. Below, you do.
Below, you do. But I'm not sure.
We'll solve it during coffee.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, I'm not sure where this conversation is going.
Look, what you're saying does not contradict what I was saying, because I'm not saying that mathematicians know nothing about such processes. I'm just saying that I was just trying to indicate that there's sort of state of development on the mathematical side, basically. That's what I was saying. That the other two theories, and actually, so I even don't know whether you're referring to Markov, multidimensional Markov, or multidimensional Markovnik. I was saying that those theories were not developed into anything usable in higher dimensions at this point. So this is why, from the mathematical point of view, Gaussian process is the nicest. Yes?
Given the process, is there a way to know how close it is to a Gaussian process? Like, whether it's Gaussian or non-Gaussian, is there a good measure?
Okay, so I would say this. In certain fields like economics, for example, basically a very rough rule of thumb is to look at the tails. You know, if the tails are heavy, for example, if the scale, you know, if they go down polynomially, probabilities, for example, the probability of a market crash, right? You're trying to think what it is. If it scales polynomially, so it goes like 1 over x to some power, that's non-Gaussian. So this would be corresponding to processes with jumps and so on. So if the tails are very light, well, then probably Gaussian processes are. I mean, economists, for example, use Gaussian processes a lot. And it's clear to me, you know, clear to me, at least that was my feeling, that when they feel that there are no heavy tails, then Gaussians are okay. It's an approximation of reality. Of course, that doesn't mean that economics is totally Gaussian, but, you know, you have to use some models. Okay, so now I want to present a number of ideas, and so this will be a random walk on ideas related to Brownian motion. So first of all, and this would be a personal choice. So first of all, let's talk about an aspect of stochastic integration. Now the thing is that for some reason, many people think that stochastic integrals are very, very complicated and deep concepts. And actually, the definition itself, in some sense, is trivial. Because, you know, if I asked, you know, people here assuming that you know nothing about stochastic integration to come up with a definition of xdd, probably this would come up, you know, unnatural. I mean, well, proving that the limit actually converges and the questioning what sense it converges to. This, of course, I mean, especially if you want to do all the deltas and epsilons, this takes a little bit of effort, so this is perhaps not completely trivial. But that's, in some sense, that's not really the interesting part. The interesting part is this, the Ito formula. And the best I can tell, this is why Ito got the Gauss Prize at the International Congress of Mathematicians last summer. It was really for this one formula. Because this is the basis of stochastic calculus. You can, in some sense, derive everything from this simple formula. If you understand this formula, then in some sense, you will understand everything else. So the formula, just in case you don't know, you see, if you forget the last term, and if you think about dB as a very nice function, or sufficiently nice, right, then this is the classical, you know, formula. This part to the left, because that's a nicely differentiable function. So. And the real interest in stochastic calculus and the Ito formula is this extra term, because it does not appear in classical set. And this makes all the difference. And well, this is related to Brownian oscillations. Basically, Brownian motion oscillates so much that it generates, I mean, if you look at the Riemann sums, and you pass to the limits, you get something extra, and that extra is over here. So, well, if you think about this, this comes basically from the next term in the Taylor expansion. And we will talk about scaling later, so if you think about scaling, it's just very natural that you get the next term from the Taylor expansion. I want to use a certain intuition in a certain explanation. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to relate the random walk and Brownian motion. So what's a random walk? Suppose we start from zero, and this is discrete time, discrete space. So the times are 1, 2, 3, and so on. The possible values of the random walk are 0, 1, I mean all integers, and at every time we go up or down the same probability, independently of what happened in the past. So that's the simplest possible model. And well, it turns out that if you rescale the random walk, so you say compress both time and space, then in the limit, in a suitable sense, you will get Brownian motion. And here we encounter for the first time Brownian scaling. Please note that we compress time a units and we compress the space square root of a units. Now, so that's the Brownian scaling. Now, if you come from the side of probability, this is your background, then you may want to think about the central limit theorem, because this is the scaling that you get in the central limit theorem, right? When the statisticians collect n data points, then the accuracy of their estimate is the square root of n. If you come from the side of analysis, then this is basically the scaling for the parabolic PDEs, like the heat equation, for the time and space scale in this way. So the scaling, in some sense, follows from the so-called invariance principle. I mean, what you saw on the previous slide was called the invariance principle. Let me go back for a second. The statement at the bottom is called the invariance principle. I wonder if anybody knows why it's called the invariance principle. It's a very strange name, and it's sometimes good to find out why. Well, it turns out that the random walk steps do not have to be just plus one or minus one with equal probabilities. What really matters is that what our expectation is and what the variance of those steps is. So the point is that the result, that the limit is invariant under the transformation of changing the step distribution. So that's why it's called the invariance principle, although you know, frankly speaking, this is not the best possible. Okay, so anyhow, this is the scaling. And here a philosophical comment. This scaling, what it means is that a constant drift has a completely different effect on Brownian motion on small scales and on big scales. So suppose that we take a Brownian motion, and for some reason we add a drift. Right, right. Some people at least believe that a stop price can be represented with Brownian motion with a drift. On a large scale, right, since this process behaves more or less, you know, sits within a parabola, more or less, so on a large scale, a constant drift will completely dominate. So after 1 million years, right, the process will look almost like going straight along a straight line, with just small sort of oscillation around that point. However, again, because of the parabolic scaling, on a very small scale, you will not see the drift at all, which is impossible because the oscillations are so big on a very small scale, which actually has an economic interpretation, right? We see sort of the, say, Dow Jones sort of trend over 20 years, 30 years, and so on, but on a scale of a few days, I mean, it's just almost meaningless to say what the drift is. You can try to estimate it, but it's just almost meaningless.
So you don't want T to go to 1 over A then?
Oh, I might have made a mistake. Let me think about this.
Nah, I don't know anything about this.
I'm trying to think about this. If I take, say, t equal, let's make a equal 100, okay? So what I'm taking here is Brownian, I take the value of the Brownian motion times 100, okay? And then, it should be divided. Okay, yep, because I have to make it. Oh well, thank you.
It's not a mistake, you just have a missing power of minus one.
Minus one, yeah. So. Maybe some new theorem. What is this theorem? Okay, yes, thank you. Okay, so now we come to the explanation of the paradox on the first slide. Cameron Martin gives some of formula I didn't know, I mean, this in mathematical terms, this is about the so-called randomly counting derivatives. So I didn't know, I mean, this is new to audience. I didn't know how many people know this concept and idea, perhaps all, just in case. So this is why I introduced the random walk approximation to Brownian motion. If you don't know the randomly counting derivative concept, then you should think about the random walk. So think about Brownian motion as a random walk. And think about, generating random walks on your computer, right? So you generate those sample paths. And then there are simple ways in which you can change the probability of various possible trajectories. That's the most trivial, I doubt that this is very efficient, but basically, if you generate certain paths, you can reject them with certain probability. And that will change the probability that any particular path will in your simulations. So that's trivial. But I'm sure that there are better ways of doing this. Okay, so you put new weight, new probability weight on the paths, and it turns out that this is the same as adding a drift to Brownian path. Your Brownian paths may look like this, then you add a drift, and they will look like this. And it's sort of clear that this should be some kind of changing the weight of Brownian paths, right? Because these paths, you know, the flat paths will be less likely, the paths that go up at a certain angle will be more likely. But, well, I don't think that it's obvious that actually the formula is this. This can be proved, and this was derived by Cameron Martin and I think independently by Kirsten, or there were different versions anyhow, different authors. I put all three names because different authors quote them or put different labels on this form. And this explains that paradox, what I call the paradox, this can be used to prove what I stated on slide number one. So actually this can be a theorem. That statement can be made into a theorem. And basically, it follows from this by basically identifying the Brownian path with the drift. Maybe I should put with minus the drift. Anyhow, if you somehow do this, I mean, that theorem will follow. Now, I'm going to mention more than one invariance. So I call it invariance two, although then I realized that this is actually already the third example of invariance to Brownian motion. Brownian motion has a number of invariance properties. My first invariance was that the increments have the same distribution over any interval of the same length. That was the first case of invariance. The second was the parabolic scaling invariance. Was the second case. It was invariance under those space-time. And this is the third invariance under time reversal. So basically what it says is that whether you look at this path forward or backward is the same. With the obvious difference is that it starts at a different point, so we have to subtract this value so that it starts at zero. But otherwise it looks the same. Okay. And I need this to explain a certain relationship between Brownian motion and the heat equation. So we take the simplest possible version of the heat equation in one dimension. UXT is simply the temperature at x at time t. And it turns out that we can represent that probabilistically using Brownian motion. Okay, so how do we do that? Okay, so to make things simple, I'm going to assume that the initial condition, ux0, is first of all non-negative, and second, that the integral of this is 1. So then mu is a probability measure. Okay, and that's a sort of just makes things easier. Doesn't make much difference, but just makes things easier. So mu is a probability measure, and ux, the initial condition, is the density of this probability measure. Well, then the forward representation of the heat equation, so this is u at yt of a, here's the point in space-time. Well, the way you can represent this is in this way, namely, you start your process according to measuring mu. Well, you run it, and then you check what's the probability that your particle happens to be at y at 10 t. And then that density gives you the forward, what I call the forward representation. It turns out that quite often the other representation, I'm so proud of this that I will run it again. I spent 15 minutes doing this. It takes only 1 second. Okay, so this is a very special, I think, very simple case of the so-called Feynman-Katz formula, and I will present a different version of Feynman-Katz in a second, but the idea here is this. You run the process in the opposite direction. So you start your Brownian motion here, and you let it run backwards, okay? Now, the reason why I wrote dt minus 1, because in my conventions, most of the time, Brownian motion starts from 0. But I don't want to start this process from 0. It starts from y, okay? So you run it until it hits 0. Then at time 0, you evaluate the initial condition at that point, okay? So here's u at time 0. And then you take the expectation, which means that you average over all paths. And this will give you the heat equation. But about the multi-dimensional Brownian motion. What I want to do next is I want to present a different version of the Feynman-Katz formula, which is multi-dimensional, which is sort of more interesting, I would say. I prefer to do it in higher dimensions than one. So what is a multi-dimensional Brownian motion? It's simply a vector of v-independent Brownian motion. And here's a, I would say, a more interesting version of the Feynman-Katz formula. So we have some kind of domain, and there are a few things here. So first of all, x represents simply a starting point for Brownian motion in the domain. So now this is a two-dimensional Brownian motion, or we don't think about higher dimensions. Let's make it a bounded domain, and we put f of x. F is some kind of a function on the boundary. At this point, let's make it, you know, bounded to avoid trivialities. And what happens is that Brownian motion moves inside the domain, and at a certain point, it is going to exit. So tau is the exit time, and b of tau is the exit point. Now, there's one more thing that we need. Namely, there's what makes things actually interesting is V. V is a potential. And then this particular equation has this particular solution, or perhaps I should say, I guess this is a probabilistic representation of the solution. Now, the easiest way to interpret this is in terms of V, if V is a positive function, because then it represents killing, and then it's easy to explain what's going on here. When you have killing, then the process moves, and actually it may get killed. Okay, so this path actually makes it to the boundary, but perhaps it will not. So what is this expression, this exponential? Well, this is actually the probability of, let me think about this, of not being killed, I guess. It's one or the other. No, this is the probability of not being killed. Because V is the rate at which the process is killed at a particular point. Right? So V depends on the location, and Brahman is killed at a certain rate, depending on the point. And some of the Brahman paths actually make it to the boundary. If they do, then you do the averaging. So you calculate that value of the boundary value at f at this point, you take the average and you get the solution to this equation to this boundary condition. Okay, so that's the, actually for some reason I think that most people when they refer to the Feynman-Kast formula, usually it's the version that has this exponential in it.
Remember that there's a generalization of this to non-stationary equation, right? When you have time dependencies, also Cauchy problems and problems there as well. Is that right?
Yeah.
I can add time here as well.
Oh, time into this, yes.
Yeah. First derivative, time derivative on the right side to zero.
So that's right. I think this is actually would be the popular version.